I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
This is David Marler, UFO researcher, and you're listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and I am joined once again by the head of the Galileo Project and the Frank B. Baird Jr. Professor of Science at Harvard University. He is a leading figure in astrophysics and cosmology, Dr. Avi Loeb. Avi, welcome back.
Wonderful to be with you.
Really good to have you. And I said Abby, I meant Avi. I've just been explaining to Avi how hot it is in the UK right now. And I'm in a bit of a heat wave hot box at the moment. And Avi, hopefully it's a hot conversation to get people interested and excited. Let's start off with yourself and the wonderful Galileo Project. Last time we spoke, you're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean trawling for spherules. And that work has now been well underway now for some time. Can you give us an update on that work and the Galileo Project in general?
Yeah, it will be my pleasure. Just keep in mind that the rest of the universe is below 3 degrees above absolute zero. It's really freezing out there.
My head will be out there then. That's great. Thanks.
Since we spoke last, two major developments took place. And the first one, most exciting one, is the expedition. We went to the Pacific Ocean in June 2023, and it took us about 9 months to analyze the materials that we found. We altogether identified about 850 molten droplets from the ocean floor, which was 2 kilometers deep when we collected the material. We went across a region of 10 kilometers in size. So, and we used the magnetic sled, a sled made of a metal that had magnets on both sides. So it collected magnetic particles from the ocean floor. Most of the particles were volcanic ash, not of interest to us. And among the sand and the volcanic ash, we found 850 spherules. These are molten droplets from potentially meteors. And that was the site that was identified by the Department of Defense based on the light emitted by the fireball when the object exploded 20 kilometers above the ocean surface. And it was relatively low. Just to keep things in perspective, there was a meteor identified above Spain and Portugal back in February this year and 2024. And that one came from the asteroid belt, and it probably came from the vicinity of Jupiter. At any event, it's solar system asteroid, and that one exploded at an altitude of 70 kilometers where the density of air is 1,000 times lower than where the interstellar meteor exploded, meaning that the interstellar meteor, I mean, both of them were moving roughly at the same speed, 40 kilometers per second, simply because the one over Spain and Portugal collided with Earth head on as the Earth moves around the sun, where the interstellar meteor came from behind the Earth. So it was actually slowed down in the frame of the Earth. And but they collided with Earth relative to Earth. They had roughly the same speed. And that means that the interstellar meteor was 1,000 times tougher. It was able to sustain stress that was 1,000 times bigger. And that's what made it quite unusual. Not only that it was moving faster than 95% of the stars near the sun, very fast, but it also was made of very tough material. And that's what excited me, because the question was, is it a Voyager-like meteor, a meteor of an object manufactured artificially? Another way to think of it, Elon Musk launched a car, the Tesla Roadster car, in 2018 as a dummy payload on the Falcon Heavy. And within 20 million years, that car may collide with Earth as it moves around the sun. And obviously, the engine could survive the impact and be on the ocean floor. And it would appear as a meteor of unusual material strength. And if nobody knows about that in advance, my colleagues would argue it's a meteor of a type that we've never seen before. And so this interstellar meteor was really unusual, and we wanted to know what it was made of. And we examined for 9 months the materials using a mass spectrometer that checks all the chemical elements that make up these spherules. And we found that 10% of the spherules, about 80 of them, were made of a material that was never identified before. It's not the same as solar system materials, the materials that made the solar system. You don't find it on the crust of Earth, the moon, Mars, or asteroids. So we had to give it a name, and we found that some elements were up to 1,000 times more abundant in those special type of spherules. Elements like beryllium, lanthanum, and uranium. And so we gave it the name Belau for those elements. But there were many others that were hundreds of times more abundant than solar system materials. And as of now, you know, it doesn't tell us if the object was artificial or natural. I also wrote a follow-up paper after the analysis was completed that argued that in principle you could have a natural process that would account for those unusual abundances. For example, if you have a planet like the Earth, which is passing close to the most common type of stars, these are dwarf stars that are about a tenth of the mass of the sun, a tenth of the size of the sun, so they're 100 times denser than the sun because the volume goes like the size cube. So it's 100 times denser. And so the sun, if the Earth comes close to it, it would not disrupt the Earth by its gravity, by the tidal force. But a dwarf star could spaghettify the Earth, basically make a stream of rocks, initially molten, because when the planet passes close to the star, the rock melts. And then half of those rocks will be ejected to interstellar space with a very high speed, similar to that meteor. And you could, because of the melting, you could actually get the abundances of elements to be close to what we saw. And so that's one origin, which is natural, but you could also imagine an artificial. So if you were to throw your laptop into a fireplace, or if you put it in your room right now, because it's very hot there, yeah, it could melt. And if you were to collect the droplets, you would be able to say the composition is unusual, but you won't be able to say it's artificial. And in order to say that it's artificial, you need pieces of the screen, you know, like the original object. And that's what we hope to do in the next expedition, that we hope to do within a year. It will be very expensive, $6.5 million. So as of now, I'm seeking a potential donor. And of course, if we get the donation, that donor could potentially be part of the expedition, be on the ship that we already found the ship that we want to use. The reason it's more expensive is we will put a robot, a remotely operated vehicle, ROV, on the ocean floor to collect the materials with a video feed so we can see what we are picking up in real time. And that's because we are targeting bigger pieces. So we plan to go back to the wreckage of this meteor and figure out whether it was natural or artificial, hopefully within a year. For now, we know that we found materials that were never recognized before. So it's very exciting. So that's the expedition part. And you can ask me more about it. And then the second part of the Galileo project is checking the sky for unidentified anomalous phenomena, UAPs, and that the US government talks about. And we built an observatory that is currently working around the clock and looking at the sky from one location near Boston at Harvard University. And we are building copies of this observatory in two places. One is Colorado, which might be moved actually around. It will be potentially portable. And the second is in Pennsylvania. We got a grant for nearly $600,000 to build a copy in Pennsylvania from the Richard King Mellon Foundation that gave us this money because they wanted an observatory in Pennsylvania for UAP. And so far we looked at about 500,000 objects with the Harvard Observatory for about 6 months, and we haven't identified anything anomalous, but if we do, you will hear about it. And we plan to, even if we don't, we will report the limits that we can put on the number of such unidentified objects, because if we look at millions of them, millions of objects in the sky, and don't find anyone to be anomalous, then it puts a limit on how frequently you get such things in a particular location. You know, it's just like real estate. It may be all about location.
It's a really interesting idea that we could potentially have other intelligences, probes, whether biological or, you know, in your head, you think of something mechanical, but what could have been coming here already that we're completely missing? And that's the idea of what you're going looking for. And even in the few years since we first spoke back in 2021 or 2022, our own technology available to the public has changed massively. And I think in the form of AI and machine learning, I wonder how has that changed your thinking, the way you're approaching this work as well, whether that's short term or long term?
SpinQuest Social Casino. It's Thanksgiving time. The turkey's hot and the family's loud. Instead of football, play a different game on your phone. Live dealer blackjack, craps, and slots. Play anytime, anywhere. SpinQuest.com. This Thanksgiving, gobble up a $30 coin pack for just $10. Come play today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So there are two types of probes that we might find. One is space trash. You know, our own probes, Pioneer, Voyager, New Horizons, you know, they will exit the solar system and then not function anymore because it will take them 10,000 years to leave the solar system, and then they will travel for millions or billions of years. And by the way, it takes... I did the calculation recently with an undergraduate student. It takes less than a billion years for Voyager. We calculated the future trajectory of Voyager and found that within a billion years, it will go to the opposite side of the Milky Way galaxy compared to the sun. So that tells you that if other civilizations produced something like it more than a billion years ago, simply because most stars formed billions of years before the sun. So it's very reasonable. Then such things could, even Voyager-like probes could be in our backyard. And, you know, there could be more accomplished entrepreneurs in space than Elon Musk's that, you know, sent cars, and some of them will collide with Earth. These are interstellar cars. And so we don't know what we might find. And, you know, we should be open-minded to the possibility that there is a lot of trash in space that will collide with Earth or pass near Earth like Oumuamua did. It could be a broken piece of a Dyson sphere. If you imagine megastructures around other stars, they will eventually be destroyed, either by the impact of asteroids. I calculated that you can't really maintain them over long periods of time because they would break up from the impact of asteroids. Or the evolution of the star. You know, if these are, for example, a Dyson sphere is made of light sails that are held against gravity, but that are levitated by the radiation from the star. If the star evolves and become brighter, as the sun will be in a billion years, it will eventually break up this megastructure. And so you can find space trash also from broken Dyson spheres, from all kinds of probes that are not functioning. And they would be on random trajectories. They will not be adjusting their motion. And so we can easily tell that they're just following gravity and falling or colliding with Earth or passing near Earth without any propulsion. But then you could have a second type that, as you say, is still functional and perhaps has a brain. And most likely the brain would be artificial intelligence because as of now, we cannot really, humans or any biological creatures cannot survive the long journeys. You know, it takes about 50,000 years to reach the nearest star with our current chemical propulsion. And it would take a billion years to go to the opposite side of the Milky Way. And it's difficult to imagine biological creatures surviving that. Of course, you can imagine modifications of biology by technology, but it's best to think about artificial intelligence that would basically allow those probes to be autonomous, to make decisions on their own, just like our kids when they leave home. You know, they don't, unless you are a helicopter parent, they are not supposed to communicate all the time with you. And they just send a postcard or call you or send on social media, update you with a brief message on their whereabouts. And the same could happen with in interstellar space. And the reason is simple. It takes too much time to communicate. At the speed of light, it takes, you know, 10,000 years to communicate with, you know, a probe that is near a star somewhere in the Milky Way galaxy. Tens of thousands of years is a very long time for a two-way communication. And therefore, it makes much more sense for the probe to be autonomous. Also, it needs, aside from needing to decide on a short time scale, it also needs to adjust to unforeseen circumstances. So AI is essential. And by the way, AI was never used in space by humans. When we sent, NASA sent probes to Mars, they were operated by engineers in the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. So it will be a new frontier for us, but we already have AI reaching very impressive levels of performance on tasks on Earth. I think the next frontier would be using AI in space. And if we are thinking about doing that, other civilizations that are more advanced than we are simply because they had more time for developing their science and technology, not just one century as we did, they would have done that by now. And that's what we should expect if we have visitors with intelligence. And in order to figure them out, we might need to use our own AI to figure extraterrestrial AI. And that would be exciting because it will be a twist on Alan Turing's imitation game. He envisioned computers imitating humans, which is pretty much what happens now with large language models, ChatGPT. They're trying to imitate us. They're serving as our digital mirror. And so when people are upset about them, I say, well, they are just reflecting our faults. You know, if people say they are hallucinating, and I say, well, I'm working with a lot of summer interns that are hallucinating, you know. And AI is potentially, you know, doing better than humans on some tasks at the moment. It's not on all tasks, but in the future, we can use it to interpret extraterrestrial AI. And if they would be far more advanced, there would be an imitation game of our AI trying to imitate higher level AI, because they would feel kinship to those AI systems more than to us if they're made of silicon as well.
The ocean comes with an obvious set of challenges when you're trying to explore it, whether it's weather conditions above and below, the depth of the ocean, just trying to find something you can't physically see. And I think as a layman, how many times we have heard of objects exploding or crashing over the centuries in Antarctica, Alaska, desert area, is that something you would entertain and would be able to look at doing, going and exploring objects in other locations that maybe aren't underwater?
SpinQuest Social Casino. It's Thanksgiving time. The turkey's hot and the family's loud. Instead of football, play a different game on your phone. Live dealer blackjack, craps, and slots. Play anytime, anywhere. SpinQuest.com. This Thanksgiving, gobble up a $30 coin pack for just $10. Come play today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Yeah, so the approach we took as of now is to flag objects that are moving too fast to be bound to the sun. These are because if they are above the escape speed from the solar system, they came from outside the solar system. That's how we found the first interstellar meteor from 2014, January 8, 2014, in the catalog that the U.S. government compiled, that NASA operates. These were the fireballs, the explosions were detected by sensors on U.S. government satellites. And they measured the speed, and from that speed we could tell it's interstellar. And now if we go back to the location of that interstellar object and find what it was made of and actually find pieces of it, that could guide us in the future, because if we now go back to collections of meteorites, those that survived to the ground, we can perhaps identify those rare ones that are similar, because only one in about 1,000 meteorites is interstellar. That's based on the rate of collisions with Earth. And it's like a needle in a haystack if you don't know what to look for in terms of chemical composition, in terms of structure, material strength. So we have the first interstellar meteor that we are exploring, but there is also a second one that we hope to go after that the U.S. government, again, identified. That one is near Europe, between Portugal and the Azores. And we hope to do both of them within the next year. And if we see that they have some similarities, then that could guide us to go back to collections of meteorites and historically figure out which one could have been interstellar. Otherwise, you really need the velocity information. And since they are rare, you know, you need to look at 1,000 meteors before you find one that may be interstellar. That's a lot of work. But that's what the U.S. government satellites are doing routinely. And we expect one or a few every decade. So they're quite rare. Those are meteors roughly a meter in size, that when they explode, they release a few percent of the Hiroshima atomic bomb energy. So they're very bright. Of course, there are many more probably that are smaller in size and fewer that are bigger than a meter. So the smaller ones, we don't expect much to survive. And that's why, you know, we want things bigger than a meter. But they are rare. They're only once a decade or once per 5 years.
You say there's a lot of work to be done, a lot of ground to cover. You need hands to do that. Now, the Galileo project has grown since you first announced it. I've just hosted John and Gerald Tedesco, who are Galileo Project affiliates, and they've been working on the east coast of the US with a wonderfully kitted out mobile laboratory called Nightcrawler. That was one of my last interviews. As we record this, Avi, it was just a couple of days ago I spoke to them. And I wonder, what do you think of that sort of, you know, boots on the ground work being done by individuals? And how can that complement the work of the Galileo Project on a bigger scale?
Well, that's wonderful, and I very much applaud their work and dedication. They're doing what needs to be done. The only issue is, how well is the data sampled and calibrated and analyzed? And, you know, that's the way science is done, and it's very nice that they're doing this, and we hope to use the more expensive equipment that we have and that we calibrated. We hope to follow their footsteps in some sense and make at least one mobile observatory that we move around. Now, the advantage of the Galileo project or the observatory that we already have in the Boston area is that we are monitoring the sky all the time for months and months. That was never done. Usually people dedicate, a week or so to a particular location. And the advantage of doing it for months or years is that you get a good census of all the things that are common, and then you can tell if there is something unusual. But in order for us to explore other regions, we really need to make a mobile observatory. We are working on that, and we hope to eventually do that. And for now, the Tedesco brothers are exploring that approach with instruments that are less expensive. And so time will tell, if there are anomalies, we will see them. And they already see some things that they don't, that they cannot account for. And so it's exciting, I think, to explore and see what's out there.
And I'll just give a shout out to them because, like I say, it was a 10-month investigation. And like you say, they put a lot of their own money into that. And that money has to scale up when you look at the Galileo project, trying to get telescopes in locations around the globe to look into the skies. But all those kind of networks. And I had a few listeners, Elena, Stephen, Charlie, who all asked similar questions about how can folks help out and support. One is donate $6 million, but that's a particular niche you're looking for, Avi, isn't it, of wealthy investor or benefactor. But right, how can folks on a smaller scale help the Galileo project or organizations like it?
Right. So we know exactly how to build an observatory now after the experience we had with the first one that we constructed. And the cost is hundreds of thousands of dollars, depending on which instruments we are putting on it. We have a cheaper version that is somewhat below that. So if there is any interest by anyone for having an observatory in their location, this is the level of funding that is needed. However, we do accept small donations, crowdsourcing, and we have a link on the Galileo Project site. And those small donations add up, and they are very beneficial for us. And so, irrespective of how much you're willing to give, even at the level of $50 or $100, we very much appreciate that. And you can find it on the Galileo Project website at Harvard University. There is an item, support us. And all of these small donations add up and allow us to build more and more of these observatories. The goal is to have tens of them or maybe even hundreds, and if we get enough funding, because we know exactly what needs to be done. We built one. It's just a question of funding as to how many we put together. And obviously making mobile ones will allow us to visit many sites.
And we know the goal of the Galileo project is to look into the skies and try and find objects like Oumuamua and others. Ultimately, with the goal, can we see something non-human, sort of non-human intelligence?
Well, so on that, I should say that next year there will be a new observatory in Chile called the Rubin Observatory, funded by the National Science Foundation. it will survey the southern sky every 4 days using a camera that has 3.2 billion pixels. So it's 1,000 times more pixels than on your cell phone, which is typically a few megapixels, a few million pixels. It would be a huge data set. We will use it to search for more objects like Oumuamua with my postdoc, Richard Cloet. In the Galileo project, we developed a software that will allow us to identify interstellar objects in the data pipeline that comes from the Rubin Observatory. We will also check for any unidentified anomalous phenomena over the southern sky in the data. The hope is that every few months there would be a detection of an Oumuamua-like object, because this telescope is far more sensitive than the one that discovered Oumuamua pan-STARRS. So there is hope that we will see more. And of course, you know, some of them may be rocks or comets, but among those rocks, we hope to see some anomalous object that could be artificial in origin. So I would suggest that if you just wait a couple of years, we would have much better knowledge of interstellar objects, and we could identify the anomalies and figure them out. Another advantage we have now is the Webb telescope, which didn't exist actually in 2017. Mm. And if we were to look at an object that is interstellar with the Webb telescope, we could detect the heat emitted by it, and that would allow us to calibrate the temperature, the surface temperature of the object. And by detecting the flux from it, we should be able to tell its size, because you can pinpoint the location of the object in three dimensions by having a telescope on Earth and a telescope like the Webb telescope that is 1.5 million kilometers away from Earth. So it's like having two eyes that allow you to pinpoint the distance and figure out the location very accurately. So we will be able to track the trajectory of the object much better precision than for Oumuamua, and figure out if there is any non-gravitational acceleration, any propulsion. But moreover, we'll be able to figure out the size of the object from the amount of heat emitted from it, giving us the temperature and then the flux of that heat that we detect. And knowing the distance, that would give us the emitting surface area of the object. And in fact, we will know the surface area perhaps as a function of time. So we could tell if the object is spinning, what is the geometry that one has for this object. And finally, if we see the reflection of sunlight from the object, knowing its area would tell us how the albedo, the reflectance of the object. And so all of these good measurements were not possible without the Webb telescope back 7 years ago. And we hopefully will be able to do it for the new objects discovered by the Rubin Observatory. So I'm very much looking forward to that. And so we will learn from a distance what these objects, what their shape is, perhaps what their composition is. If they, for example, shed some mass as a result of being heated by the sun, or just from the reflectance as a function of wavelength of the light that we see. If we ever wanted to land on such an object or take a sample of it, that would require billions of dollars, because you need to engage with the object along its path and then maybe come close to it. And those kinds of missions, since these interstellar objects are moving relatively fast, they are much more difficult than the mission of OSIRIS-REx, that space mission that NASA launched to collect materials from the asteroid Bennu. That material was brought back to Earth and has been analyzed. And by the way, I should say that the analysis resulted in very similar plots and diagrams to the ones we obtained for the interstellar meteor from the ocean floor, except our mission was $1.5 million in cost, and almost, you know, like a factor of 500 less than the cost of the OSIRIS-REx mission. It's very expensive to engage with an interstellar object. It's much easier to collect materials from the ocean floor.
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You're right, the James Webb Telescope has produced some amazing pictures, and I love the side-by-sides of what we were seeing just 7 or 8 years ago compared to what we see now, and what that's going to look like in 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time is incredible. I'm going to ask, though, Avi, our conversation so far has been out in space. We've been under the ocean, and I'm going to pull your feet back onto ground for a few minutes. You were on a YouTube show recently called The Basement Hangout, an interview I really enjoyed. I thought you were incredibly relaxed on it, which is always a good sign the guys on there are doing a good job. And you made a comment that a former high-level official from Lockheed Martin had paid a visit to your home, and you asked about the claims of David Grush and the material that he talked about, and I can see why you would have an interest in that. And he said, regarding that situation, I would say that is not wrong. And you mentioned on the show you were surprised at that. You maybe expected the more negative response. You've also had an hour-long online meeting with David Grush. And I wonder, what has that done to your thinking of the claims that were made? And does that change or impact your way of working?
Well, I'm very intrigued indeed by those instances that you mentioned. And at the same time, I should say that, for example, the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office keeps saying that they haven't seen anything unusual. That in fact, 97% of the UAPs that were reported by military personnel that they looked into can be explained as drones, balloons, things that they understand. Of course, this may be of interest for national security to say we understand what 97% of the objects are. But from the point of view of a scientist, even if one in a million of those objects happen to come from outside the solar system, that would be big news for humanity. And so I'm really interested in the 3% that they cannot identify. And I think it's very difficult if you rely on reports from the past to figure out, you know, and if the data is not conclusive, you can't really do much about it. So a much better approach is to build the observatories and look at the sky and not rely on government to tell you what lies outside the solar system. That's not their day job. Their day job is national security. What lies outside the solar system is my day job. That's why I'm doing it. I'm very intrigued by what David Grush said, but unfortunately, we haven't seen publicly any information or any data that relates to what he was talking about. And he says that he's unable to release that information because of legal restrictions, and I fully respect that. And the only problem I have as a scientist is that I have to see the evidence in order to figure out what it is. So just a couple of weeks ago, I gave a public lecture on Capitol Hill, Washington, D.C. It was an evening event, and I was secretly hoping that someone will take me to the corner of the room after my talk and say, Avi, we have the materials that you're looking for, and we just need you to sign these NDAs and non-disclosure agreements, and we need your help to figure out what they mean. But nobody came to tell me that, and I realized, you know, it's quite possible that if the government has something that they are keeping it secret, not clear to me why would they do that for things that were retrieved decades ago, because it doesn't reflect any national security threat at the moment, if it's from so long ago. So there are two possibilities, and I'm frank about it because I'm not sure which one is correct. One possibility is that they do have something and they keep it secret in order to avoid disrupting society simply because they don't know what it means. They still want to figure out whether it can be used to the advantage of the U.S. And the second possibility is, of course, that there is nothing of that nature, that in fact the retrieval and reverse engineering programs are all about trying to find the crash sites of equipment from adversarial countries, you know, like planes or missiles, and then reverse engineer those to figure out what those countries are doing. And they give it the title extraterrestrial or artificial, just in order to confuse the public and to introduce some noise into the system that will prevent, you know, citizens from knowing what it's about, or foreign governments from knowing what we have. And so they introduced this narrative of it being alien technology, but in fact it's human made, and they're just using the best tools to analyze it. That's why it's secret, and that's why it's classified. And, you know, there are these people who say the government cannot keep a secret because even the Manhattan Project was leaked. So that would be consistent with the second possibility. And the idea is that as part of a counterintelligence effort, they would introduce this noise into the public thinking that, you know, there are things that are maybe UFOs that, while in fact, maybe it's technologies that other governments are using in crash sites, or technologies that the US is developing and they don't want anyone to know about. So either way, it's human made. So that's the second possibility. And for me to figure out which one is the correct one, I need some data. I need to see materials. I need to see the evidence. And I can tell you if I see it, what it means. But as of now, this was never disclosed. So, you know, it's possible that Grash is very sincere, but it's all about things that were human made. And it sounds as if it's not human made just in order to confuse adversarial nations about what the U.S. is doing. Or it could be that he's correct. And, you know, it's really so classified that even the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office doesn't know about it. So I'm pretty much in the dark about which possible interpretation is the correct one. And I will base my assessment on any evidence that is presented to me. Now, my point is it's not really appropriate for the government to hide anything that has nothing to do with national security. They should share it with scientists so that we can figure it out, because, you know, whatever lies beyond the solar system has nothing to do with national security. They don't care about our borders, and the government doesn't have necessarily access to the best scientists in the world unless they share it with those scientists.
I think people appreciate, one, most people, I won't speak for everyone, that you are honest and candid about this, but you are at least willing to talk about the subject and speculate about the potential hypotheses, whereas I know you've been rather outspoken. Other professionals such as Neil deGrasse Tyson in the UK, we've got Professor Brian Cox and others, have been far less willing to entertain the chat.
Well, on that, I would mention an anecdote, because about a month and a half ago, I wrote a paper, my latest paper that was just published, about the fact that there was a claim that over the past year that gravitational waves, ripples in space-time, were detected from collisions of very massive black holes at the centers of galaxies when galaxies merge. And the detection was based on jitter of the solar system under the influence of those passing gravitational waves. And the period of those waves is a few years. And I just pointed out that the model used for the motion of the sun did not include the relatively big rocks in the asteroid belt. These are rocks big that are up to 80 kilometers in diameter, almost 10 times bigger than the rock that killed the dinosaurs. So there are a bunch of those in the asteroid belt, and there are just, you know, hundreds of them. And so it's very tedious to include all of them in the model of the solar system. So it was, they were left out of the model. And I showed that, in fact, those rocks introduce jitter to the sun because they move back and forth. And over a period of a few years, which is exactly their orbital time around the sun will execute some random walk when it's subjected to these hundreds of objects kicking it around. And if you don't account for those, it might be significant contribution to the signal that was detected. So I just pointed this out. This signal was detected relative to clocks that are pulsars, very precise clocks that we detect. These are rotating neutron stars that emit a beam of radiation, just like lighthouses. And we can time the arrival of those pulses as they sweep through our line of sight. And use it as clocks. And that's the way we figure out that the sun is moving or jittering under the influence of gravitational. So I pointed out that it could be these rocks in the asteroid belt. And I got an email from Neil deGrasse Tyson the same day that I posted my preprint. And he said, well, it's refreshing to see you providing a mundane explanation to a more exotic phenomena that someone else proposed, because usually you do the reverse. He was making fun of me in the context of Oumuamua, where he thought that I'm suggesting something very exotic when everyone else says it's a rock. And I said to him, I wrote to him in email that I enjoy going against the wind. It's a lot of fun. And I suggested you should try it sometimes, because his approach is very much trying to be liked by everyone. He never suggests something that might actually be different than the beaten path. And sometimes, you know, you need to rock the boat because the boat is heading in the wrong direction. And that's what I feel in the context of the search for intelligent life. I think we are not investing enough funding, and we're not looking for, I mean, to me, it sounds like, you know, common sense to say that we are not alone because there are so many stars, hundreds of billions of them in the Milky Way galaxy, and a substantial fraction, maybe a quarter, has planets like the Earth. And just arguing that we might be alone is arrogant. And I'm not saying that all of these civilizations exist right now, but they could have existed in the past, and therefore we could find space trash, and their trash will be our treasure, because we will learn about them. If we find a tennis ball from a neighbor, we would know that the neighbor plays tennis. So I think of it as a very commonsensical thing to do, to search for objects from outside the solar system. It's something that was never practiced before the last decade, because only over the past decade, we discovered Oumuamua, the meteors that I mentioned, and a comet named Borisov. So it's a new frontier, and it's very exciting. And also unidentified objects near Earth, you know, these could be functional devices. We should be open-minded to that. And indeed, the mainstream physicists are trying to push back and sometimes attack me personally. Initially, I was troubled by that, but now I, you know, my skin is made of titanium. I don't care much. I'm just trying to do what makes sense. And I think that eventually when we find the clear evidence that nobody can deny, it will become mainstream. And those people, by the way, there is a philosopher named Arthur Schopenhauer who said that the truth comes in three stages. He said the first stage is when people say it's completely wrong and they trash it and they push back and say, and they insult whoever proposes it. The second stage is they say, well, you know, there are good reasons why we should consider it more seriously, but it's still incorrect. And then the final is when the evidence is conclusive, they say, well, we thought about it first. And it's actually evident. It's self-evident, and there is nothing, you know, really special about it. And you can see that in many events in scientific history. You know, one of them, let me just mention those that are related to rocks. You know, before 1803, it was claimed that rocks cannot fall from the sky. These were meteors. Mm-hmm. And in 1803, there was a meteor shower in Liège, France, where many eyewitnesses saw the rocks and they were found on the ground. And then even scientists started to argue, yes, indeed, rocks can fall from the sky. They don't just exist on Earth. And then there was the idea by Alfred Wegener in around the 1910 that he was actually an astrophysicist to start with, but then ventured into geology by arguing that if you look at the Africa and the Americas, it seems like the shores were actually fit together, and you can bring also Antarctica on the other side, and Asia and Europe and North America, and they were all part of a supercontinent. And he just based it on the, like a jigsaw puzzle, all the pieces fitting together. But the mainstream was ridiculing it initially, dismissing his idea, and he died without his theory recognized. It took about 40 years before people realized that, in fact, the vegetation matches, not just the and also the type of rocks. When they analyzed in the 1950s, they realized that it matches. And so then it became clear. And then the explanation was plate tectonics. And he is considered now the father of that idea, but he died 20 years before his theory was recognized, and it took 40 years. So these are two examples. And now, of course, when I went to the expedition, a few astronomers published a paper in the Astrophysical Journal saying that the U.S. government data must be wrong. In fact, the speed of the object was probably two times or three times smaller because they could not fit the data with a stone from the solar system. And of course they couldn't, because we argued that this material must have been tougher than solar system materials. But they argued, therefore, the data is wrong. And my point is, you cannot be more arrogant than that as a theoretical physicist to say my model doesn't fit the data, therefore the data is wrong. They said the U.S. government measured it wrong by a factor of two. That's the U.S. Space Command that advises the U.S. president on ballistic missiles that may be launched from North Korea or from Russia. They detect the speed of the object by through the heat emitted by the engine. And it's the same approach as to measure the speed of a meteor that collides with Earth from the fireball that it generates. And so they were arguing in a published paper that the government data is wrong. And they did it a year after the U.S. Space Command confirmed that the object is interstellar by looking at the data again. We came back at the same time. We came back from the expedition with materials. So you would ask yourself, why aren't they curious? Why couldn't they just wait for us to come back with the materials and analyze the materials? And to me, it sounds like deja vu. Once again, you know, rocks introduce a controversy among people who know what to expect, but refuse any new knowledge about rocks. And they would always interpret things coming from the sky as stones from the solar system, rather than consider the possibility they might be interstellar in origin based on the data.
Well, Avi, in the short time we've got left, I want to try and get through a couple of listener questions. I had over 50 for you from all across the world, so you're a very popular guest when you come on. And the first one takes you to a rather speculative area. Kate wants to know your thoughts on the recent Nazca mummies that have been presented around the globe by a multitude of scientists. What are your thoughts on those?
SpinQuest Social Casino. It's Thanksgiving time. The turkey's hot and the family's loud. Instead of football, play a different game on your phone. Live dealer blackjack, craps, and slots. Play anytime, anywhere. SpinQuest.com. This Thanksgiving, gobble up a $30 coin pack for just $10. Come play today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Well, I haven't examined them, and I don't know what to make of the information that we received from Mexico. I think we should, I mean, just the fact that they look strange does not mean that they're not made of Earth. And one way to figure it out is basically to study the isotopes, the chemical isotopes in those mummies. And that could tell us whether the age of the isotopes is... the age of the Earth. If they were made from the Earth, if they were, for example, produced by artificially by someone who is trying to fool us, like made of animals or anything made of materials that are found on Earth, we can easily tell that. And I haven't seen any such analysis, you know, to indicate that if it came from another place, we should have materials that chemical composition or isotopes in particular that indicate that it's not solar system materials. And that was not provided. There were claims that indeed these are extraterrestrials, but it wasn't in sufficient detail for me to believe it at the moment. So I'm still agnostic about the nature of those things.
That's fair. A question from Peter. He asks, or he mentions first, government and military whistleblowers complain of threats and intimidation, as have some researchers and scientists. For example, Dr. Gary Nolan on this podcast and others mentioned threats to him. These threats are more than friendly suggestions that the topic of this phenomenon is a risk to your career, but it can shouldn't be explored full stop. And he wonders, has that ever happened to you and in what form?
No, it never happened to me. Maybe the distinction is that I never signed any non-disclosure agreement, so I'm not at risk of violating it. I don't know anything that may be classified on this subject. And as I mentioned before, the subject is sensitive, especially if there is nothing extraterrestrial that the U.S. government knows, and it's all to do with technologies being developed. But it could also be that there is something extraterrestrial, the U.S. government just classifies it in a way that they don't want any leakage of that information. The point is, I never received any threat, and I have no idea whatsoever what the U.S. government has beyond what was released to the public. And the other individuals, maybe Gary Nolan was signed on something and therefore he cannot really talk about it. Maybe, I mean, obviously that's what Lou Elizondo is saying. So that doesn't apply to me as of now. I don't know. I know nothing about what the government may have.
And I'm sure you're happy to not be threatened by anyone either.
Well, it's just my belief that anything to do with national security is not of interest to an astrophysicist like myself, right? I don't care. All the conflicts we have here on Earth, you know, they are not my topic of what I care about. I care about what happens outside the solar system and whether we have a neighbor, a partner out there. And that should not be of great interest to the U.S. government, in my opinion. They, if they have any clue related to our cosmic neighborhood, they should release it. And just the way, suppose they figured out that the sun is made mostly of hydrogen. That's not information that could affect, humans on Earth. And or if they learn something new about the Big Bang, you know, that is not classified information. And so, in my opinion, if they have something, especially if it's from 50 years ago, that came from outside the solar system, they should just share it with scientists. On the other hand, of course, anything to do with national security, they should keep the lid on. I hope that to hear about anything in the first category, and I don't want to hear anything about the second category.
That's fair. A question from Algo. He says, there is a hypothesis that UAP, in the sense of UFOs, behave in ways we cannot explain with traditional physics. In Avi's opinion, are there other astronomical phenomena, unexplained astronomical phenomena, that cannot be explained by our traditional physics?
Yes. So the answer is yes to both questions. And what traditional physics explains is quite impressive, but there are big holes in our understanding. For example, we don't know what most of the matter in the universe is. We call it dark matter. It's invisible. We haven't witnessed it. We don't know what it's made of. 85% of the matter in the universe belongs to this substance. 85%. So just imagine that we were to figure it out and engineer it. Then we could use it, let's say, for propulsion, and nobody would be able to see it if you could engineer it. But we don't know what it is. We cannot interact with it easily. But other scientific civilizations might know how to use it. The other thing we don't know much about is the dark energy that fills up the universe. It's the energy of the vacuum, and it produces repulsive gravity. The universe is not just expanding, but at the moment, as the universe expands, the density of matter and radiation gets diluted. Okay, and eventually you get to a point where the vacuum dominates the mass budget. And that's where we are right now. And at that point, the universe starts accelerating. So in the second half of cosmic history, the universe has been accelerating because of the vacuum. Now, this is repulsive gravity. If you could bottle that energy, that dark energy, if you could put it in a bottle, it would produce an object that has a negative mass, basically creates repulsive gravity instead of attractive gravity. And just think about it. If you take an object with a negative mass, place it next to an object with a positive mass, then it would repel the positive mass object, whereas the object that has positive mass would attract the negative mass. So the two would accelerate indefinitely and reach the speed of light with no need for any fuel. So a negative mass allows you propulsion just because gravity is repulsive without needing any fuel. However, a negative mass also can allow you to build a time machine, because usually near a positive mass, you suffer a time delay. That includes even when light goes near a positive mass, the clock is ticking more slowly close to a positive mass. However, if you have a negative mass, the clock is ticking more, I mean, faster than far away. And so you could go back in time, in principle, and build a time machine. Whether we can have a time machine or not is unknown. As of now, most physicists argue, no, it's not possible because you get logical inconsistencies. I mean, for me, I ask, well, if time machine is possible, why is nobody going back in time and killing Hitler, who caused a lot of damage on Earth? Maybe they don't know about human history, those that have time machines. But the point is, we haven't figured out whether it's possible to bottle the dark energy, as I was talking about. So these are two examples, dark matter, dark energy, where we definitely know that we don't understand their nature and there is physics beyond the standard model. But of course, there are other questions about, for example, what came before the Big Bang. And I can imagine that if we understand that with a proper theory of quantum gravity, you know, you need to unify quantum mechanics and gravity to figure it out, then we might be able to produce a baby universe in our laboratory. And I can imagine advanced scientific civilizations reaching that milestone, having quantum gravity engineers and being able to produce baby universes. And, you know, they subscribe to the job definition of God. If they can produce universes, they can apply for the job of God in religious texts. So that's why I'm so fascinating with an encounter with a more advanced scientific civilization, because we can learn much more about physics that we don't understand, and we would be at awe, religious awe, with the miracles that they can produce. But I should also say that when you see something that you don't quite understand, it doesn't mean that there is new physics, unless you have very good data that is basically cannot be explained at all by conventional physics. And very often in UAPs, people just say, oh, the object was behaving in a strange way, but that's not sufficient. You really need extremely high quality data to show beyond any reasonable doubt that new physics is needed. And, you know, physicists are working for decades on finding new physics. Whenever something is discovered, they get a Nobel Prize. It's really difficult to find new physics. So that's why we need better data on UAPs.
Avi, you have hit the hour mark quite expertly there. I'm sure that was almost deliberate. So we'll leave it there. Thank you so much again for your time. All the links we've discussed will be in the description for the podcast. Go and check out the Galileo Project. Avi, it's always wonderful speaking to you, and I look forward to having you back on again in the future.
Thanks for having me.
That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show out on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify, just search That UFO Podcast Premium, YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and smoked.
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend, because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.